Welcome to the Education Investment Podcast. In a world where investors are looking for stable and growing long-term returns with social impact, the education sector is becoming increasingly attractive. We speak to leading educators, operators, and investors in the education sector around the world to explore this growing investment theme alongside our listeners. From preschools to K-12 schools to higher education and vocational education, from edtech to education infrastructure, from VC investors to private equity and family offices, we explore it all. I'm your host, Monde Ngosi. Education has always been a big part of my life because my mother founded a school which was across the road from our home. I have benefited from excellent schools and teachers in South Africa and the US. I went on to study education and am now very grateful to be an investor in the sector that I love.
All opinions expressed by podcast guests are solely their own opinions. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions.
Today, I am privileged to host Amogelang Mutumi for a conversation on student accommodation in South Africa. We'll start off by exploring the role of accommodation in student outcomes. Then we'll dive deep into the student accommodation landscape in South Africa. We'll also discuss the investment case for the sector and understand its key risks. Amo is a seasoned real estate investment professional. He is currently the fund manager of the Growth Point Student Accommodation REIT, which owns the largest student accommodation portfolio in South Africa, serving more than 10,000 students. It was also one of South Africa's first unlisted REITs. Prior to that, Amo was head of real estate acquisitions at the Public Investment Corporation, or PIC, which is the largest asset manager in Africa, with assets under management of 2.7 trillion rand, or roughly 150 billion US dollars. He started his career in construction at CCC Management and in investment banking at Nedbank. He holds a BSc in construction studies and a BCom honors in financial analysis and portfolio management, both from the University of Cape Town. He also holds an MSc in real estate investment from the University of Reading. Amo, it's wonderful to have you here today. Welcome to the pod.
Thanks for having me, Monde.
Wonderful. So as we start, before we get to student accommodation, I'd love to learn more about you and your journey. So tell us where you grew up. Tell us a bit about your family and your journey to where you are today.
No, thanks for that. I grew up in Kimberley. So when I was growing up, Kimberley was a mining town. And I say was because it's no longer a mining town. The biggest employer at the time was De Beers, but my parents worked for government. So my mother worked for the municipality, and my father worked for a government department. I've got two siblings, an older brother and a younger sister. My sister is 15 years younger than me. So she had a completely different life to the life that my brother and I had. So when I started school shortly after 1990. So I was quite lucky in the sense that when I started school, South Africa was changing. There was obviously a move towards a more integrated society. So my parents made an effort to make sure that we get a quality education. I remember driving in the so-called suburbs on a Sunday looking for schools that my parents thought would be appropriate for me to go to. I managed to get into one of those schools, and then from there got into a high school again in Kimberley. Subsequent to that, I went to Cape Town to study construction studies, as you've mentioned. On completion of my studies, I joined a company called CCC Management. At the time, I'd gotten an offer to go to a big construction company. But I decided to join this company because it had two founders. I was the first employee, effectively. So I thought that even though they were paying me less than the big construction company had offered, it would be a good opportunity to get a lot of experience. And also, I was quite impressed by the offices. So very superficial, but yeah, I was impressed by the offices. And I liked the interior architecture of the offices. That was a good time for me. I learned a lot. The founders of the company would take me to meetings with the CEOs of the developers. We were rendering services to developers. So I got a lot of good experience at a very early age. At one of the meetings that I went to, we were debating whether to build a building using concrete or steel. So the theory is that steel, you can build quicker using steel. So a developer will save on the interest costs during construction. But steel is more expensive than concrete. So I just remember the client at the time saying, listen, guys, you guys can debate as much as you want to. The key question is whether how much I'm going to save by using steel versus the additional cost. In that meeting, I realized that the people that make the decisions in property are the finance people, and not necessarily the construction people. So you can have a lot of technical skills, but the ultimate decision makers make financial decisions. That's when I rolled to do a BCom. And when I completed my BCom, I joined Nedbank. That experience really opened my eyes to what the real estate sector entails. Because when I joined Nedbank, all I wanted to be was to be a developer. And I got exposure to property developers, unlisted funds, family offices, large real estate investment trusts. So I got involved with a lot of deals. I was very fortunate to have a good manager at the time who also gave me a lot of exposure. I then decided that I needed to get a bit more, a different experience. And one of my colleagues had just moved from the UK at the time. And he said, and I was considering doing an MBA. So my colleague said, listen, don't do an MBA, go and do a master's in real estate. And he recommended the master's in real estate finance and investments at Reading. I was a bit stupid because I would literally commute to lectures, once a quarter, from South Africa.
Okay.
So most people would commute to either University of Pretoria or University of Cape Town. I would get on a flight to go to the UK.
And this is while working in investment banking. So
this is while
period in your life.
Exactly. This is while working in investment banking. But it was a good experience. I met a lot of people. A lot of my classmates were professionals that are in the real estate space in Europe. So we had people from the Netherlands, Italy, Germany, and I got to see how people do things differently, in Europe. When I attended my last module, I was sitting with my classmates and I said, geez, I don't know if I made the right decision coming here because I've done the calculations. This is how much I've spent. And I don't think I'm going to get a job in South Africa that's going to pay me enough for me to get a return on investment. And one of my classmates just said, listen, it's not about the job or the money. It's about the experience.
Yeah.
So I've always valued experiences. And subsequent to that conversation, I value them even more. Yeah, maybe let me pause there for now.
I loved it.
I've gone forever. Let me pause there for now.
You've gone on and given us an overview over so many decades. You've given us a great overview. I really enjoyed it. I'm going to take you right back to the beginning where you started. And this is growing up. You've got two siblings, in Kimberley and your parents both working in government. There you are in Kimberley. You decide that you want to work in construction. So I'm interested. What was it that initially attracted you? Just when you were a child, it's clearly important to you. You even mentioned the interior architecture of the place you worked at. Yeah. So what attracted you to that when you were young?
So I was introduced to technical drawings in primary school and I really enjoyed it. So in primary school already, I thought I wanted to become an architect.
Okay.
Then that evolved in high school. I decided that I wanted to be a structural engineer. And then I thought, I don't like physics. So I then decided that let me do quantity surveying. So that's really how I got into the construction sector. It was a love for technical drawings in school.
Okay. Sounds like you were an old soul as a youngster. In primary school already.
In primary school, no, absolutely. People, whenever I tell people that I knew what I wanted to do in primary school, they get a bit shocked.
And it's wonderful. You're still in the space. Clearly that passion was real and it's grown and lasted. Yeah. Another thing I'm interested in is growing up in Kimberley. Kimberley is quite a diverse place. I'm interested in what are some of the languages that you've picked up over your life and growing up in Kimberley.
Yeah. So Kimberley, because it used to be a mining town. We had people from different cultures. So it was common to have Xhosas and Zulus and Sotos all living in one community. But the main languages were Setswana, which is what I speak. And the second most spoken language in Kimberley is actually Afrikaans. So I used to speak fluent Afrikaans.
Okay. That will help with construction, no doubt.
No, absolutely, absolutely. I've started using it again after joining Growth Point.
Okay.
And then the third most spoken language is English. Yeah.
Okay, understood. And then you mentioned that both of your parents worked in the public sector.
Yeah.
In varying roles. And you yourself, over the course of the career, have gone across both public sector and private sector. So I'm interested in your reflections on that. There's not many people you speak to in South Africa who've got the experience in both. How has that shaped you?
It's been very valuable in my life. So what motivated me to go to the PIC is that we have a lot of relatives and family friends that are in the public sector. They are either policemen, nurses, soldiers, etc. So I knew a lot about the PIC. I knew the type of work that they were doing, and I knew that they were the custodians of public servants' savings. So when I joined,
by the way, my mother, who receives her pension every month.
And my mother-in-law.
Exactly. Public sector, right? Pensions, yes.
So that was my main motivation. And while I was at the PIC, they were always in the media. They had bad press, right? Mm. And I would get my mother's friends calling to say, should we take out our pensions? You know, you get people just calling you, asking what's happening. Is our money safe? And I'd always tell them that, no, your money's safe. Stay invested. Don't resign and take your hard-earned savings. The longer you are in the market, the better it is for you. So yeah, that was my motivation. And from an experience perspective, again, it was very valuable. I just come from Nedbank, where I'd had a lot of exposure to real estate. But then when I was at the PIC, I got to see how it fits into a multi-asset portfolio effectively. So if you go to the investment committee, the discussion was about a particular deal, but also where the capital should be allocated to real estate versus fixed income, or unlisted real estate versus listed real estate. So you had to get a good sense of what other asset classes were doing, beyond just what you were doing on a day-to-day basis, looking at real estate transactions.
Mm.
The negatives, there was a lot of red tape, but I think state institutions have to have the red tape because they obviously look after the public's money, whether it's the government employees pension fund or the unemployment insurance fund. You are the custodian of taxpayers' money. Even though the government employees pension fund consists of savings of public servants, but it's guaranteed by the state.
Mm.
So the public in general has a vested interest in how that organization operates. So that was quite frustrating for me, having come from an organization which was big, but where transactions happened quickly. And the thinking at Nedbank was very entrepreneurial. So we could always find solutions for some of the problems that our clients had.
That's wonderful. Those are great reflections. And it really, you have a unique profile for being where you are today.
Yeah.
It's almost perfectly suited. You've had boots on the ground experience in construction.
Yeah.
So you're not sitting in a glass tower or an ivory tower. You know what it'd be like to be out there actually building the buildings or supervising that. So in construction, in investment banking, then focused on real estate and then investing in real estate at the Public Investment Corporation, which, as I mentioned, is the largest asset manager in this country. And then now managing the fund at Growth Point, which some of which we'll talk about a bit later in this conversation. So I think it really is unique. And then being able to bring together both that public sector and private sector together, which, by the way, most of the investment industry is, because a lot of the pension funds are public, large pension funds are public sector pension funds. So a lot of the investment industry is really a partnership between the private and the public sector. So it's a wonderful skill set for where you are. So the last question on just you personally, before we come to student accommodation, just what are some of your main interests outside of work? What are some of your sports teams and what do you like to do?
Interests, I enjoy watching football. I'm a Liverpool fan.
As am I.
And a Kaiser Chiefs fan in South Africa.
For our sins.
For our sins, exactly. Yeah, yeah. I used to enjoy running, but injuries have just, I've stopped running because of injuries. I've got back problems. And I've gotten an interest in the arts recently. Just seeing what young people are doing, creating, their creativity and what they can produce and the talent that they have. I was saying that being, I guess, an artist or visual artist, you need talent for that. Whereas everything else in life you can learn. But I don't believe that you can learn to be an artist. I think you need to have a natural talent for it. So I find that quite interesting.
I'm intrigued by that, actually. So intrigued that I'm going to ask you another personal question
before
we move on. Just staying on the art. I mean, when you think of your role, you do have such a big impact on the built environment and what we see around us, what we drive past. I actually drive past one of your buildings every morning on the way to drop my daughter off at school.
Yeah.
And the building is opposite the school. So really, this influences what we see every day. Has that interest and passion in art found its way over into your professional side as well?
Yeah, it has. We recently commissioned a young artist to do a mural at our building. She's a WITS student, doing a MA in fine arts. And going forward, I've told my team that we need to try to bring art as much as possible, whether it's procuring furniture pieces, from local craft people, or having murals or just having different pieces of art, in our properties. But the key is they have to be local, right? So one of the criteria for the artists that the mural at the building that you drive past every day was that they had to be from Johannesburg. And in Durban, if we do something, we'll get an artist from Durban. If we are in Cape Town and we do something, we'll get an artist from Cape Town. It's the easiest way to give back to your local community. And considering that artists don't make much, right? So the least we can do is make sure that we procure from local people that are around our properties.
That's beautiful. And it roots it in the community that it's in.
One
of the features of real estate is it's physical. It's a physical structure.
Yeah.
So no, that's absolutely wonderful. And I really appreciated learning about you, your family and your path up until now. And, we'll move on then to some of the topics for discussion in student accommodation.
Cool.
So my first question to you on student accommodation is just why we should even be discussing this at all on an education podcast.
Yeah.
So what impact does accommodation have on the outcomes for students?
It's got a positive impact, but not all accommodation has a positive impact on the outcomes of students, right? So historically, if you go to university, you'd either stay on campus. Those are traditional residences that universities own, or you had to stay in a commune with a few friends. But over the last 15 to 20 years, what has happened globally is universities haven't developed enough beds, because they've had to focus on investing in teaching and research infrastructure, because that's their biggest asset, really. We all go to university because of a university ranking. That has left a gap in the market for the private sector to invest in that space. But the private sector invests in what we call purpose-built student accommodation. So the properties are built specifically for students. The infrastructure that we provide is to make sure that students will have a positive academic outcomes. We also have a program that ensures that we support students. We call it a wraparound support program. We have a psychologist where if students feel like they need psychological assistance, they can consult with the psychologist. We have programs on entrepreneurship, mentorship, academic support. So it's not just the physical buildings, it's the entire offering that the sector is providing to the market. And it's the entire offering that leads to positive academic outcomes ultimately. Because historically, if you live in Res, you've got community number one. Number two, you are close to campus. And thirdly, you have the infrastructure around you to enable you to succeed.
Okay, that's wonderful, Amo. And clearly, it's a lot more than just a bed. You know, this Absolutely. Is very different. The you mentioned the things of the psychologist, the additional academic support, and that explains then why it's not just any regular apartment building or something Absolutely. Of the kind. Why it's out purpose built. So something else I'm interested in there. Selfishly, I'm a father of two girls. Mm-hmm. They're a long way from university at this stage, but they will get there at some point. And one of the other, as we think about broader student outcomes, one of the biggest things for me as a parent is safety. Because if I think back to my time, I used to study really late, and you know, walking back to where we live, etc. How have you thought about that element? And it's also one of the key elements of student outcomes.
No, 100%. Safety is it's key for us. So firstly, the locations that we invest in, we make sure that we invest in safe locations. Where it's not, South Africa is obviously a place where it's not 100% safe. Mm. But we are part of, suburb improvement districts, right? So if you look at Hatfield, where we have four properties, we're part of the Hatfield improvement district. And in Braamfontein, we are part of the Braamfontein improvement district. So, the landlords in a particular suburb contribute towards the security and the upkeep of that suburb. So that's your surroundings. When it comes to the actual property, we've got biometric access. So people can't just walk in and out. Only students that are registered at that particular property can go beyond the security checkpoint. We've got 24/7 security. We've got CCTV cameras across the property. In all the common areas, passages, stairwells, etc. So we make sure that parents feel comfortable to leave their children there. Many students come from outside of the place where they study. So if you're coming from Venda and you're dropping off your child in Braamfontein, you need to be absolutely sure that the child is living in a safe place. Yes, there may be incidents outside of the property which are beyond anyone's control, but where they sleep at night, any parent wants to make sure that there's the safety.
100%. Yeah. No, it's, I think very clear to me as you're talking through, that accommodation is actually critical to student outcomes for people in university. Yeah. Both the stuff you talked about, like academic support, the psychologists, that safety element, and even just the practicalities of life in a country like South Africa where, we oftentimes have load shedding. So you've got to make sure that there's ways for the students to study late at night. All the points you mentioned around being able to, you know, the secure access and all of that, that students can continue at 11 o'clock to study, you know, and it puts people on a more equal playing field. So I'm convinced, as I was coming into this, this is an important topic in education.
And so, sorry, Monde, the most important amenity is Wi-Fi, right?
Positively and negatively.
You can have you can have a couple of days of no water, which we don't because we provide backup water and backup power.
Yes.
But don't you dare have 10 seconds with no Wi-Fi.
I hope
they'll be all right.
TikTok is not allowed on your Wi-Fi. I'm just teasing. No, that's lovely. So with that context then on why it's important, let's move on to the fund that you run, the Growth Point Student Accommodation REIT. I gave some context up front on it and, you know, serving over 10,000 students. But let's go to what was your motivation for launching it and where does the portfolio stand now?
So our motivation for launching it came from investors. So just to give you some background, in 2016, Growth Point started a fund management business. The intention of the business was to pursue a capitalized strategy where Growth Point will start real estate businesses that don't compete with their core business of investing in office, retail, and industrial assets. So the first asset class they invested in was a healthcare fund that acquires and develops hospitals or pharmaceutical facilities that have a high barrier to entry because you would need a license. Mm-hmm. Leading up to 2021, discussions with a number of investors led to the establishment of this purpose-built student accommodation REIT, because a lot of investors were saying, we are looking for a product that we can allocate capital to in the student accommodation space. Mm. So that's really the genesis of this particular business that I run. The fund was officially established in 2021. We bought a portfolio of 7 properties from a developer that had built 4 properties in Pretoria and 3 in Johannesburg. That portfolio had 5,000 beds, and we've subsequently doubled it. We've built another 7 buildings, and we've added 5,300 beds to the portfolio. So in total, we've got 14 operating assets. And 1 property that's currently under development in Durban, right outside UKZN Howard campus.
Okay, that's a lot of progress since 2021. I'm intrigued that the investors were coming to you and wanting, and these are institutional investors, yeah, pension funds, yeah, and wanting to put capital into student housing. I'd be interested in what do you think some of those motivations were?
Look, having spent time at the PIC, so the PIC is probably the single largest investor in student accommodation. The motivation for an investor is to make sure that you get high levels of graduations, because it's proven that purpose-built student accommodation leads to positive academic outcomes, which we've spoken about. But by getting high levels of graduation levels, you are likely going to reduce the unemployment rate. The unemployment rate in South Africa for graduates is 11%, versus a national average of about 33%. Mm. So already you can see that graduates have a higher probability of getting employment. So if you can get students to have quality teaching and research, which they have in South Africa, if you can add accommodation to that equation, you are likely going to get better academic outcomes. Higher levels of graduations, higher graduation levels mean that you have a productive society. And a productive society means that people can buy a house, they can buy a car, they can get insurance. So what we used to say at the PIC is that let's sacrifice the return on the student accommodation investments, because if these students make it through university in large numbers, they will go and buy a property. That means whatever we've invested in that does housing will do well. They'll go and shop at ShopRite, at Pick n Pay. So our investments in those companies will do well. Mm. They'll buy a vehicle. They'll get insurance. So the ecosystem becomes better. You'll get better returns in other asset classes if you can get more people in employment. And one way to get more people in employment is to make sure that they get an education.
That's understood. So it's almost an investment in the future of the country.
Absolutely.
Is the way that they were looking at it.
Yeah.
And that makes perfect sense, you know, for pension funds, both public and private sector.
Yeah.
There's the commercial requirements, which are needed in any investment, and which we can talk about the investment case a bit later. Mm-hmm. But that broader question of what are we doing in a society with, as you say, 33% unemployment in the country as a whole. I see why there was the push towards student accommodation and the social impact that it creates. So, you know, so you're up to now 14 buildings in various parts of the country, Joburg, Pretoria, you've mentioned the Durban one that's coming up and various others as well. Talk me through the profile of the students that are living in your properties.
Yeah. So we house males and females. 67% of our students are female. And
is the male and female in the same building, by the way? Or
it's in the same building.
Okay.
Interestingly, they prefer that, right? They prefer that.
I did when I was in university too. Thank you.
But
just didn't allow us.
But I think this generation is completely different to when we were growing up. So we had a lot of pride living in a particular race with a particular history. They're not tied to that history. So the likes of Smarts, Leo Marquard, this generation doesn't really care. What they care about is the brand and the levels of service that you give them. So we house both males and females. So we have different typologies. We've got sharing rooms where two students share a room, like the traditional rezas. And then we have apartment style properties where you'll have a 2-bedroom apartment or 3-bedroom apartment, etc. We don't mix the genders in an apartment or in a sharing room.
Okay.
But we do mix the genders on the floors. So you'll find that if you have a floor that only has men, it's always noisy. So we thought let's manage the noise levels
in the corridor.
No, exactly. So let's manage the noise levels by bringing in females. So from a gender perspective, as I said, it's 67% female, 33% male. We house students from all walks of life. From a student that is funded by NSFAS, to a student that's very wealthy, whose parents can afford to pay 100,000 rand a year, buy them a car. But the experience has to be consistent. So the student life program I was telling you about is consistent across the board. Safety and security is also consistent across the board. So there are certain things that we don't compromise on. The only difference in the product depends on whether you've got a swimming pool, a gym, or other additional amenities.
Okay. That's wonderful. This last point that you mentioned, the diversity of where the students are from, is one of the points I appreciated the most about my own university experience.
Yeah.
The acronym that you mentioned there, NSFAS, that's the National Student Financial Aid Scheme, which supports students who come from families below a certain threshold of household income to support them to go to university. And as you say, everything to, you know, students from really wealthy families, and you're living together in a single place. And that diversity is something special about university. At school, there isn't as much diversity in most schools. And then again, you know, working life, things can get narrow. So it's a special time in our lives. And if I come then to why there's the need for the private sector here. If I think back to when I was in university, most, although not all, even then you had some private sector, but most of us lived in university-owned residences. And you have had, obviously, a big growth in the number of students coming in. So why aren't the universities just building more themselves?
Yeah. So universities get funding from the state, and then tuition. So about 90% of university funding comes from government grants and tuition. That funding has conditions where you need to teach a certain number of students. You need to produce research, etc. So what has happened is the money that universities receive has had to be invested in teaching and research infrastructure because they're under pressure to admit more students. That means they have to build more lecture halls. They're under pressure to produce research as part of the funding that they receive. That means they need to invest in labs or academic research. So they haven't had enough capital to build accommodation because it's just not core to their business. And then the returns on teaching are higher than the returns on owning accommodation. So that's why universities haven't invested in building accommodation, even though the numbers, the number of enrollments have been increasing over time.
And, you know, this is a very real problem. I think back to my first year, actually, during orientation week. I recall one particular student, I obviously won't say the name, but had come from Limpopo via train. And arrived at registration and didn't have a place in res and didn't actually have a place or wouldn't have otherwise had a place to stay that evening. So this is a very, very real problem. The numbers going into higher education, so the demand has increased, but the supply, you know, without the impact of the private sector like yourselves, we'd have a lot of people who can't afford to rent an apartment or something like that in nearby areas. So very real problem.
It's a real problem. My first choice of university was the University of Pretoria, but I didn't get res, and I got res and obviously got accepted to UCT. And my parents said, well, you're going to UCT.
That was the bet in the end. Okay, got it. And I'm intrigued by your relationship with the universities then, because you've touched quite a bit on the universities and their own funding, et cetera. So what's your relationship with the universities, and where are the students that live in your buildings? Where are they studying?
So we've got good relationships with the universities. We understand that we need to coexist. So we build a property, the university then comes and accredits the property to make sure that it complies with the minimum norms and standards. So the Department of Higher Education and Training has minimum norms and standards of what a purpose-built student accommodation should be. So the university is the entity that gives you that accreditation. But in addition to that, we just believe that they are key stakeholders to us. So we make sure that wherever we invest, we meet the university management, we introduce ourselves, they must know who we are, and if there are any issues, we can talk to each other. They're a big stakeholder. They're very important to us. And where we are invested, the students that live in our properties study at WITS, University of Pretoria, University of Johannesburg, University of Cape Town. And we also have students from private universities. We've got students from Varsity College, Rosebank College, EFTA, EduForce, and some of the other private institutions.
Got it. Understood. So both at public universities as well as at private institutions as well. And you maintain active relationships with
the stakeholders. We do. No, absolutely.
Let's talk then a little bit about the government, and I'll also include, even though it's an agency, the NSFAS as well. So let's take the government and the National Student Financial Aid Scheme. What role do they play in the student accommodation sector?
So the government, the Department of Higher Education, gives NSFAS the budget, and then NSFAS is responsible for vetting students and paying their tuition, accommodation, and allowances. So historically, all payments have gone through the university. So NSFAS would say that, Amo, you qualify for this bursary. You want to study accounting. The cost of studying accounting at WITS is X. Your accommodation is Y, and your living allowances are Z. So NSFAS would pay the university the full amount that is due to AMO, and then the university would pay all the different service providers. But two years ago, NSFAS decided that they want to pay students directly. So they'll pay the university the tuition, but they want to pay the landlord the accommodation amounts directly, and they'll pay the student their living allowances directly. So that has taken time to transition to that new model. So some universities are already using that new model. Some are using the older model where they receive all the funds from NSFAS and then they disperse it to the different parties.
Okay, got it. So the government clearly and the NSFAS play an important role in this sector. Yeah. It's not the whole sector. I mean, some of the students would be paying themselves in their own capacity and some would be funded by NSFAS. And what you just described sounds like quite a complicated arrangement.
Yeah.
It's the, for those students who are on NSFAS, it's NSFAS which is paying you on behalf of the student. So I'm intrigued how that pricing works then. Does the NSFAS have a sort of limit on pricing, or is the student find something that fits their budget? How does this actually, who chooses this accommodation?
The student chooses the accommodation. So they will shop around and they'll say that I like Apex Studios in Bromfontein. I want to live there. NSFAS will say that your accommodation allowance is 52,000 per annum for 2025. So if you get accommodation that's less than 52,000, great, the government saves. The government saves because they're paying less. Yeah. If your accommodation is more than the 52,000, there's debate whether students should pay that difference. So for example, if your annual accommodation is 55,000, typically you would sign a lease for 10 months. So NSFAS would pay 52,000. The 3,000 balance has to be paid by the student. So the 3,000 comes from either a parent. A student will say, my parent can afford to pay 3,000 over 10 months, which is 300 a month. Or the student could say that, listen, I can afford to pay this amount. I've got a business. I'm a tutor. Mm-hmm. I've got a job, etc. So students make that decision. But we've had numerous focus groups with students just to try to get an understanding of what their views are. All of them understand their financial circumstances. So there are students that will say that, listen, I can only afford to pay what NSFAS gives me because my circumstances are dire. I need to send some of my allowances back home because my family depends on me because I'm a NSFAS. There are students that say that I want to live in a safe and secure place. I can afford 150 rand a month, well, 200 rand a month. And they find ways. I mean, the one student that I've come across used to do hair, right? So she'd braid her peers and other people's hair. They'd come to the res. She'd sign them in. They'd sit in the room. She would do the hair, and that's how she made extra money to be able to afford the extra things that she wants. So yeah, it's very interesting.
Okay. No, that's great. Look, we've spent a good amount of time here understanding the student profile, the role of the various stakeholders, government, the National Student Financial Aid Scheme. And it's very clear to me that fixing this supply demand problem in student accommodation is absolutely critical to the country. So I admire the work that you're doing and already serving over 10,000 students. So I'm going to transition us slightly then into looking at this from the investor perspective. It's the education investment podcast. So give me, how would you articulate the investment case for purpose-built student accommodation in South Africa?
Look, firstly, there's a structural undersupply of accommodation. You mentioned the student you met at UCT who came from Venda and didn't have a place to stay. So in 2020, the IFC did research, and they estimated that there were 500,000 beds. There was an undersupply of 500,000 beds in South Africa. And they also estimated that by 2025, that number would increase to about 780,000. So demand exceeds supply tremendously. So that's.
And just to be clear on that report, so that was from the International Finance Corporation, the arm of the World Bank Group.
Correct.
Okay.
That was from the International Finance Corporation. It's a public document, so it's available to everyone that is interested in their findings.
Okay. Understood. So they said there's a shortage of 500,000 beds today with the increasing demand that'll grow to 780, I think it was the number.
780.
Somewhere in that sort of.
Correct.
Okay. So big undersupply. Yeah.
Big undersupply.
Yes, undersupply.
Undersupply. Correct. Yeah.
Undersupply.
Yeah. Secondly, it's a very defensive asset class. Whenever investors do a due diligence on us, they get worried that we don't have long dated leases that typical real estate investors have, and that they want as pension fund investors. So we enter into, as I said, 10 month leases, so on an annual basis. So this year we signed, about 10,000 leases. So next year it'll be 10,000 again. 2027 it'll be 12,000. But even though we sign leases annually, the sector is very defensive. So when we bought the initial portfolio from the developer in Pretoria, we did a due diligence on the initial 7 properties. In 2020, during COVID-19, the occupancy rate in that portfolio was 85%.
Wow.
Which is good, but it's low compared to our annual averages. So typically, a good occupancy year for us is 95%. Mm. In 2020, that portfolio had an occupancy level of 85%. And the students, the 15% that had vacated their accommodation were from wealthy families. Mm. Because they could go home where you've got your own room, you've got internet, you've got all the infrastructure that you need to learn online, because universities had migrated to an online learning, online teaching model. The NASFA students, as soon as the COVID-19 regulations were relaxed, moved back to accommodation because that's where you can study. So we don't think that online teaching and learning in South Africa will disrupt the need for face-to-face teaching and learning, just because a lot of students don't have the infrastructure to do online schooling effectively. Mm-hmm. And also the relationships you build when you're at university. All my closest friends that I met at university, I met in RES, mm-hmm. Because that's where we spend most of our time, outside of lectures. Mm-hmm. We're seeing good rental growth. So for investors that's looking to invest in real estate, they're obviously looking for above inflation rental growth. We've managed to achieve that, except for 2023 when NASFAS rebased their rentals. But generally speaking, we're seeing above inflation net rental growth. So the demand, supply dynamics are good. The defensive nature of the asset is good. We're seeing rental growth, and the barriers to entry are also high, right? So real estate typically is capital intensive. For student accommodation, it's even more tricky, because for you to go and get equity or loan from the bank, and you say that because our model is build it, they will come. So you don't have,
student doesn't sign the lease before you start building.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. So it's very difficult for banks to underwrite counterparties that don't have the track record.
Yes.
And in some areas, like our property in Durban that we're currently building, we've had to assemble a site where we've bought 3 houses. We've demolished the houses. We've rezoned. We've consolidated the 3 urban into 1 property. And now we're building. Mm. So again, for a private investor to try to do that will be very difficult.
Mm. Understood. Okay. No, I think I get that quite clearly. So it's the structural undersupply in the market, and the demand for higher education is going to continue growing. So as the IFC has said, that undersupply is likely to, or that demand exceeding supply is likely to continue, unless we increase supply. The defensive nature of it, and you've had a test run of where people went online and still you had 85% occupancy in that period, and then the rental growth and the barriers to entry, which also include accreditation, right? As you said, you've got to get sign off from the universities, you've got to get national student financial aid scheme, and your payment rails in place, and we know that can be very challenging and time consuming and take a long time. I see that investment case, and what type of investors have you managed to attract to the fund and asset class?
Pension funds, investment holding companies, and family offices. So all of these guys are looking for financial return and social impact. Yeah. They do have different mandates, but generally speaking, that's what they're looking for.
Okay. We've spoken quite a lot about that social impact side. So I'm keen to hear about the return side. So, you don't have to talk about your fund in particular, but let's just take, purpose-built student accommodation in South Africa. How do you think about a reasonable return expectation? What kind of return can an investor expect?
Yeah. So a reasonable return would be anything CPI plus 4 to CPI plus 7. As I said earlier on, investors are willing to sacrifice a bit of return, knowing that the impact is going to be very positive and they can make up the returns in the rest of their portfolio, whether it's the equities portfolio or the private equity portfolio.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's consumer price inflation plus 4 to consumer price inflation plus 7.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear how you sort of get to those numbers. What kind of, either an entry cap rate or is it CPI linked increases? Just some sense of how you get to that expectation.
You make or lose money, when you do a development or you acquire a property. Mm. So we target a yield of between 9% and 10%, for new developments or acquisitions. We've had to build all our properties so far, except for the initial 7 properties we bought, because there isn't a lot of investment grade stock, that we can acquire in the market. The prospective sellers of these assets, have unrealistic price expectations. So we've just ended up having to develop our own properties. And then, as I said, income return about 9 to 10%. Mm. And then the balance is capital growth of 3 to 5%.
Understood. Yeah. That makes perfect sense. And how do you think about leverage?
We conservatively geared, because we are a REIT, and we have to distribute income twice a year. Leverage, we don't really use leverage to enhance our returns. We use leverage as a form of raising additional capital to meet our investment objectives. So our gearing, ranges from 35 to 40%. We can go up to 50%, but we prefer to be conservatively geared. So when we go to investment committee with a deal that has a 42% loan to value, they get nervous.
They start to sweat.
They start to sweat.
So it is a conservative gear.
It's a conservative.
Okay, no, that makes sense. I see how you get to the CPI plus 4 to CPI plus 7, yeah. as a realistic return expectation. And yeah. thanks for sharing that. If I come then to that's the upside. But every industry has risks. Every industry has landmines that people have stepped on. So to an investor who'd be new, let's say, to the purpose-built student accommodation sector, what are some of the key risks you'd want them to be aware of?
First risk I would say would be governance. You are very dependent on different areas that require good governance. So firstly, local authorities. If you buy land with a view of developing, you need to make sure that you can get your plans approved. Mm. And you can get them approved quickly because with a purpose-built student accommodation property, you don't have the benefit of opening your doors in March. You need to make sure that your property opens in Jan so that you can lease it up, because you've got a 2-month window to fill up your building. So local authorities are key. We do a lot of due diligence on local authorities to make sure that wherever we go to, we can get good service levels. Mm-hmm. Secondly is university governance, right? You don't want to go to a place where you can't get accreditation, because the university governance is poor. Mm-hmm. We've had an instance where we've built a building. We thought the target market would be a particular institution. The institution didn't accredit us because the municipality was on strike. And then the municipality couldn't give us power.
this is not a good advert for South Africa that you're going into, right?
And the university couldn't accredit us because we didn't have power. But fortunately, sure. The University of Pretoria took a commercial view and they said that we can see the building is up. We can see the beds are in. We can see everything is in. We will give you accreditation. Once you get the power from the local authority, come and talk to us so that we finalize the accreditation. Mm. So that talks to governance from both local authority and the university. Just shows you that it's critical, right?
Absolutely.
Other risks are a lot of investors see the National Student Financial Aid Scheme, NSFAS, as a risk. We don't see it as a high risk, right? Because the...
They worry that it'll go bankrupt or go away.
Yeah, yeah. They worry that it'll go away.
Okay.
Our view is that, it's more expensive for the state not to fund the education of its young people. Right? So if you don't fund 18, 19, 20 year olds, they're sitting at home, they're probably going to abuse alcohol, drugs, do crime, and that cost to society is much higher than funding them to get higher education.
Mm.
We do think that the model might evolve over time.
Mm.
Currently it's a bursary, it's got a criteria, but it may evolve over time, but we don't think that it will completely disappear.
Okay, understood. Okay. No, those are very real risks that I see them, both the regulatory approvals and the local municipality, the university accreditation and NSFAS. It also then speaks to, I guess, what makes, you almost have in-country champions, because these are fundamentally quite localized problems that need a sort of local expert, and why it would be hard to have a huge global student accommodation, let's say business, it's quite localized.
Yeah.
Okay. No, that's clear. So if I look forward then, let's put our five-year hat on. What are you excited about? Are there any specific areas or of the country that you're expanding in, or universities or themes or innovations in general in student accommodation?
We're looking nationally, but particularly in the Western Cape. We've got one property in Cape Town, 560 beds. So you see that the balance of our property is in Gauteng.
Mm.
So we're looking to invest in the Western Cape and in other parts of the market. We spend time in PE. Well, Gqeberha.
Yes, yes.
We obviously investing in Durban.
Yeah.
And we're looking across the board.
Okay.
The one thing we've learned is don't assume a university is of a certain standard depending on where it's located. We found very well-run universities across the country, even in some of the rural areas. So we're excited to go and invest in those markets. The second thing I'm excited about is just building a business, building a culture, building values, defining our purpose. We currently employ more than 100 people. That's going to increase over time as we build a portfolio. So what keeps me up at night is making sure that we've got a good offering for talent. We can retain the talent, and we can develop our own culture and our own purpose, and values. And hopefully we look back in 5 years time and we say, geez, do you remember when we couldn't get accreditation in Pretoria?
No, absolutely. That's wonderful. And, yeah. And add on top of that, so something we spoke about right at the beginning, which is the art, which for me, as someone driving past your buildings frequently and seeing them, is something that I think will be great as an addition across all of the buildings that you do. And it adds to the built environment around us.
Absolutely.
So that's wonderful. Okay. Look, it's been a great conversation on student accommodation. And I'm going to come back now to you as I ask my concluding question. So same concluding question to all my guests.
I'm a fan of the show, so
please ask
the question.
So there it is. It's please tell me about your favorite teacher or educator.
So my favorite teacher was my maths teacher in high school. His name is Mr. Adaide Boachi Yarom. He's of Ghanaian descent. A very good maths teacher. And when I think about the people he's taught that are doing scientific things, right? I mean, we've got a neurosurgeon. One of my classmates is a rocket scientist, but he did a master's in rocket science. But I don't remember the maths much, to be honest with you. I just remember the wisdom that he would share with us. He had this poster at the back of his classroom that said that If I hear it, I forget it. If I see it, I remember it. If I do it, I know it. And his whole thing was maths is a doing subject, right? You need to practice maths so for you to know it. But that lesson I implemented in life. All our properties where we've invested, I've walked the streets because I need to feel what the student has gone through. It's not enough just to drive around. I need to do what the students do for me to understand their experiences. I once took a colleague of mine to Bromfontein and we were scared. And I said, come on, let's meet.
You're in the wrong industry.
Exactly right. You need to walk the streets of Bromfontein, for you to know exactly what students go through and how you can improve their lives. The other quote he had was the beautiful ones are not born yet. So he always used to say that stay away from girls. So I went to an old boys school. He said, stay away from girls. The beautiful ones are not born yet. Your time will come. So a brilliant, brilliant teacher, and a very wise man.
Yeah. Sounds like more than a teacher. Sounds like a mentor, in an important time in a young child's life, in a young boy's life, in your instance. So that's an absolutely wonderful tribute. And I've thoroughly enjoyed the conversation across the private sector, the public sector, purpose built as student accommodation and learning more about you. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And thank you for taking the time today.
No, thanks for having me, Monde. Really enjoyed it.